I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, 2019. Present today, we have Representative Knopp, Representative Lebon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Representative Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And as we start, just a reminder, folks could please mute their cell phones. And today's presentations will include the FY20 Departmental Budget Overview of the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development, and the introduction of House Bills 53 and 54. House Finance will begin with the overview of the Department of Education first, and I'd like to invite the Office of Management and Budget Director Lacey Sanders and Administrative Services Director Heidi Teschner to the table, if you could both put yourself on the record. And I'd also like to recognize that the Commissioner of Education, Michael Johnson, is here today to answer questions regarding policy impacts of the budget. So with that, if you could both please identify yourselves, and just a reminder to help with transcription, if we've got a back and forth conversation, if you could just state your name, and that'll help the folks out. So with that, please continue and proceed.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Budget Director for the Office of Management and Budget.
I'm Heidi Teschner, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Education and Early Development. And we're just going to go right into this. So on slides three before you, it shows a fund group and position type comparison for the Department of Education and Early Development. Between FY19 management plan and FY20 governors amended. Starting with the left-hand side is the funding comparison. So the fiscal year 2019 management plan budget totaled just over $1.6 billion. The total combined general funds is the one, just $1.348 million. Of which $1.321 million is unrestricted general funds and $26.5 million is designated general funds. And overall, these general funds account for about 81% of the overall budget. Other funds represented in the green bar are $64.8 million, and it's about 4% of the overall budget, and federal funds, $251 million, about 15% of the overall budget. And the department's FY2020 governor amended budget total is just over $1.3 billion. Total general funds combined is just over the $1.031 million, of which $1.013 is unrestricted general funds and $18.8 million is designated general funds. And this accounts for about 76.8% of the overall budget for 2020. Other funds are $61.6 million, or 4.6% of the overall budget, and federal funds is the $250.2 million, or 18.6% of the overall budget. And overall, the FY2020 governor's amended budget is $320 million less than the FY19 management plan. It's about a 19.3% reduction. So continuing on with the right-hand side is our budgeted position comparison from FY19 management plan to FY2020 governor amended. In FY19, there was 289 total positions within the Department of Education and Early Development, and the proposal for FY20 is 282 positions. This is a reduction of seven full-time positions. Five of those positions are associated with the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and they're related to the proposal to repeal and eliminate that, eliminate the council. And there's one permanent full-time position associated with the elimination of the Online with Libraries program, and then transferring one full-time position, my administrative services position, to the Office of Management and Budget. So the following slides will address some big changes, notable changes to the department's budget that impact the general funds. So on the first bullet is the statewide support for the executive branch 50% Travel reduction, and it's a total of 146.6 general fund reduction. The total department budget for this reduction is $353,000. And the second bullet is a reduction to the foundation formula funding program of almost $270 million. This proposal repeals the appropriation made under HB 287 that was to be effective July 1, 2019. This proposal underfunds the formula. There is no change to the base student allocation. And the funds will be prorated based on Alaska Statute 1417-400B. And the BSA equivalent of this reduction is about $4,880. And the current base student allocation is $5,930. And then the last bullet on this slide withdraws the one-time future funding for school districts of $30 million. Again, this is a proposal to repeal an appropriation made in HB 287 that was to be effective July 1st, 2019. Any questions? Okay, moving on to slide five. The first main bullet on this slide is the withdrawing funding for the WAMI Medical Education Program of just over $3 million general funds. The total appropriation funds 80 WAMI students, 20 students of which are 20 students each year, so a total of 4 years. So 80 currently in the system. The program is delivered by the University of Alaska Anchorage via the University of Washington School of Medicine. From calendar year 2014 through calendar year 2018, the percent of graduates participating in Alaska has decreased from 84% to 61%.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That particular line that you just spoke of, from the calendar year 2014 through the calendar year 2018, the percent of graduates practicing in Alaska has decreased from 84 to 61%. Are you comparing apples to apples there? It's my understanding that the 84% figure included some people who were not Alaskans, but that came to Alaska to work, and versus the reduction to 61, we're talking measuring only Alaskan residents participating in the program and returning. Does that make sense to you? Have you heard that? Have you heard that issue being brought up?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, actually have not heard that it includes one, whether it includes all students or just Alaskan students. I have not heard, I have not, to my knowledge.
Alderman?
Chairman. So, reading from an article here that was published in, the ADN. The 84% figure was large because the calculation included Alaska students and students from other WAMI states who ended up in Alaska, while the 61% figure included Alaskan students only, according to WAMI, the WAMI organization. So, in essence, what they're saying is you're not, that figure that change from 84 to 61 is not based on the same group of people that we're talking about.
Chair Foster, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we can definitely look into that a little bit further. I just don't know off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is a question for Commissioner Johnson, but you know, for the state of Alaska, we have an incredible need for physicians here in the state of Alaska. And I think WAMI's success has been, in and of itself, a real positive aspect of actually growing our own and having physicians come back to Alaska and serve here. We've had that in the Mat-Su Valley. So I've been a real strong supporter of the WAMI program itself. If this goes away, what will be in its place?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, if this goes away, my understanding is the students that participate in the program would have to then compete at a bigger level The applicant pool that they're competing against is a larger amount. So these 20 kids, these 20 young adults who are applying for this program, it helps them by not having such a larger, like I heard the number of 7,000 applicants that they'd have to compete against if this program went away, if they went to other programs in the across the United States.
Representative Ortiz.
When you use the term compete against, are you talking about competing for admittance to the University of Washington Medical Program, or are you talking about competing for scholarship dollars because part of the program allows students to have, 50% of their costs covered as long as they return to the state and work in the state? So in what sense are you talking about competing?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm referring to competing, like if a medical school only has so many slots available and they only let so many kids in and 7,000 apply, you know, you might only accept 100 of those 7,000. So it's competing against that kind of thing, not for scholarship money, just competing to get into a school is what I think I'm referring to.
So I'm correct in the understanding that if the program does go away, Alaskan students would need to no longer have the benefit of having 50% of their tuition costs waived by returning to the state of Alaska. That benefit would go away.
Through the chair, that is correct. That would go away.
Through the chair.
Ms. Sanders?
For the record, Lacey Sanders, through the chair, Representative Ortiz and Representative Sullivan Leonard. I would like to also add, this was a proposal that was put forward as each of the agencies are walking through what their core services are in the department. This is not saying that this may not be a valuable program, but that the focus of the Department of Education and Early Development is truly looking at the services that are provided to the K through 12 group, and this fell outside of what those core services were for the department.
Thank you, appreciate that.
Representative Johnston and then Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Chair. A follow-up to that, does that mean that it might not be a core service for this department, but it might be a core service for health and social services?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, that is a fair question, and I don't know that necessarily health and social services might be the most appropriate. This program is delivered through the universities of Anchorage, or excuse me, of Alaska. That there could be conversations on if there is value in having that in that area.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Actually, not a follow-up, another question. If we took this budget cut and we didn't apply it to another place in the budget, so in other words, it went away, would Alaska be the only state in the union then that has no medical program for its residents?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I don't have the answer to that. We can follow up and get information back to you.
It would be nice if you could follow up and also maybe give us, a spreadsheet of what other programs are offered in other states.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, we can follow up with you on that.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnston asked my question.
Please continue.
So 60%, again for the record, Heidi Teschner, 60% of WAMI students return to practice in Alaska. As noted, that Alaska does have a shortage of physicians, but with a declining return of students is a primary reason why this reduction is in front of you. And the WAMI, while Alaska needs 60 plus physicians each year, WAMI contributes 14 plus physicians each year to meet the need in Alaska.
Did you
And then the last bullet on this slide, the Alaska Performance Scholarship, we just wanted to note that that program is continuing. There is a fund source switch underneath that program from the Higher Education Investment Fund to unrestricted general funds. But again, the program is expected to continue.
Representative Ortiz.
Just from my own understanding, I had a question from a student constituent today about this very topic. Appreciate the fact that the program quote is going to continue. With this fund switch, will it change in any way in terms of how it's operated in the past compared to how it's operating now?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Yes, through the my understanding is that the program, there's no change to the program itself, none whatsoever. It will continue as set out in statute and as it's been implemented. It's just the fund source switch of how those scholarship applications are paid for. What source of fund pays for them?
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how much is in the Alaska Performance Scholarship account?
Chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'm going from my memory here, but it's approximately $450 million.
Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, and thank you. We're looking at core budgeting here, and we're looking at missions, and I was just I'm kind of interested why this is now out of the mission. I understand the Alaska Performance Scholarship Fund and what it's trying to do, but it's also got, it seems to have some synergy with the performance scholarship, because you're applying it to a lot of the same students. And so I was just interested why theoretically it wasn't part of its mission.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, are you speaking to the Alaska Performance Scholarship?
Yes, but you know that the fact that you switched it out of the now I can't even remember the name of the fund, the
Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Out of the fund from the general fund, where I see some synergy in the missions and same population.
Thank you for that clarification through the chair, Representative Johnston. The reason the proposal is put forward to change the funding source from the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund to the general funds is because there is a proposal to, it's part of the conversation of eliminating the quasi-dedicated funds that we've been having. The administration has legislation or will be putting forward legislation that will eliminate quasi-dedicated funds. The higher ed fund is a part of that. And so the proposal before you changes the funding source to continue the program with elimination of that other fund.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Ortiz.
Just make sure I'm understanding if there's any opportunity cost of making this change or not. The scholarship performance, the Alaska Scholarship Performance Program, comes right now out of revenue from the Higher Education Investment Fund. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, in FY 2019, yes, it is coming out of the fund.
And then, follow up. And so then, that fund you said had $400 million, is that what you said?
Chair, Representative Ortiz, it has approximately $450 million in it.
$450 million. And so have they been able to pay for those or provide the scholarship assistance through this program from returns on investments, so that basic fund hasn't, the principal fund hasn't eroded? Is that correct?
Chair, Representative Ortiz, it's interesting that you asked that. The fund was initially set up to be utilized for the Performance Scholarship Fund. Previous legislation has utilized that funding source for other sources outside what that statutory designated purpose is. I can't speak to the eroding of the balance of the principal of the fund, but I do know that the amount of funding that was being utilized was growing over years to be used in other programs that were outside of this performance scholarship program, which goes back to the conversation that we've been having about the quasi-dedicated funds, where a fund is being set up for a purpose and essentially dedicating those funds while the legislature still has the power of appropriation and can use those funds for other purposes. This change puts all of the funding from the Higher Education Fund into the general fund and allows the funding for the program to compete with other programs utilizing general funds. It was a priority of the administration, and the program is continuing.
So am I correct in understanding that at least one opportunity cost would be if you no longer have the Alaska Performance, if you no longer have the Higher Education Investment Fund as a separate entity that was invested, that goes into the general fund, which, so you're going to lose the investment returns, correct? Because the general funds, they're not invested for returns. They're just in the general fund. So by moving it in to the general fund, you are losing those potential returns. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm not an investor, so I can't speak, but I think you have a good logic there that their returns may not be as great in that it was previously sitting in the higher education investment funds. The administration's view is that there should not be quasi-dedicated funds and that all programs should compete on equal field for the general funds that are available.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I guess I'm a little confused in that this concept that everyone should compete, you've said that, in fact, ultimately, while there may be some sort of quasi-dedication, there's been some capture or use of funds for other purposes anyway. So historically, there's been a legislative understanding that there's, you know, there's some vulnerability there, and nothing is dedicated. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that is exactly the point, that none of the funds should be dedicated. I think there is often a misunderstanding with statutory designated funds that they can only be used for a specific purpose. And as you mentioned, there is no constitutional dedicated funds. I think that with the proposals that are being put forward to eliminate the quasi-dedicated funds, it will provide clarity that there is one fund, which is the general fund.
Follow up. Even though I understand the intent, I think that each of these, including PCE in a similar vein, was designed for a legislative purpose that succeeding legislatures recognized and largely honored by not dissolving them and subsuming them into the general fund. My concern is that conceptually the public will view these things differently. And, you know, you use the term, it allows these programs to compete. They don't want to compete. They want to be recognized, and I guess I'm concerned that competition can be healthy, but this is really just a forerunner to their being dissolved. Why shouldn't I be worried that they'll just be dissolved?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I can't convince or make statements on, you know, what could happen in the future. The proposal in front of you is to continue the programs, and I think that this proposal is merely an opportunity for the legislature to have clarity in its budget and not creating a whole bunch of funds that the public may not understand that these funds are not dedicated for that purpose. I don't think I can speak to the future for you and that things won't be eliminated or changed. But I think also that it's the the legislature has the power of appropriation, and for the purposes and the projects that they want to put forward and appropriate funding for, and that all projects should compete for equal funding, and that is the legislature's role to determine what is a priority.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Next slide.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to slide 6, again for the record, Heidi Teschner. The next two slides will provide the notable items that were reducing the pre-kindergarten programs and early learning grant programs. It's just about $16.8 million general fund reduction. So the first one we'll talk about is the Head Start grants. This is a just over $6.8 million unrestricted general fund reduction. The Head Start grantees are required to have a 20% match on their federal grants. And that match must come from non-federal sources, and it can be in-kind donations or from local cash matches or contributed from any other source, just as long as it's not non-federal. The state is not required to provide this match, but the state has been providing this match for these grantees for a number of years. This appropriation, as I said, has served as the match on these Head Start grantees federal applications. I just want to note that the Head Start entities receive about approximately $46 million in Head Start money from the federal government. And so the matching funds, those funds and the matching funds, the department doesn't have oversight over. This is merely been used towards that, but it's not a requirement. We are one of one, maybe, or a handful of states that actually provide a match to their Head Start grantees. So many states do not provide this, and their Head Start agencies are functioning in those states.
So, Ms. Teschner, if we don't provide the $6.8 million, does that mean that all of that 46, it leverages all of the $46 million federal money? Is that correct?
Chair Foster, no, it does not leverage the full amount. And so there are 5 of 16 Head Start agencies that receive this $6.8 million, and 5 of the, or 16 total, but 5 of those actually have waivers from the federal government, so they don't have to actually meet their 20% match. So it, we're distributing the funds, but it's not in all cases used towards their match. In most cases, it is.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you for that answer. You're saying that we're one of the few states that do this. Do you know of other states that have other government entities, be it counties, boroughs, in other words, a sub government entity that does do the matching funds?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I do not know that off the top of my head, but we can research it and get back to you to give you a clear answer.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would it be accurate to say that while the $6.85 million doesn't leverage the $40 million, was it $40 million? $46 million? Mm-hmm. Do you know how much it does serve to leverage? Would the figure $25 million ring a bell in any way? Terms of would it leverage $25 million of federal funds?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, actually have not done the math to know if it is the 25 or not. So I don't have a clear answer for you. I'm really sorry.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a policy call, so could I ask that the commissioner come up forward and talk a little bit about this particular item?
Commissioner Johnson, if you could put yourself on the record, thank you for being here.
For the record, my name is Michael Johnson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you, Commissioner, for being here with us today. Commissioner, you were the Commissioner of Education in the prior administration, and during those particular last couple of years, you worked on a particular for lack of better, I didn't know, I can't remember the name of the term, but you worked on a program to improve schools. What did you call that? Not just you personally, but you worked in cooperation with lots of different groups around the state. And can you remind me what that was called?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's the Alaska Education Challenge.
Alaska Education Challenge. And as a part, it's my understanding, as a part of the Alaska Education Challenge, one of the things that you wanted to work towards improving outcomes statewide is literacy by the third grade. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, there's five goals associated with the Alaska Education Challenge, the first one being that every student can read proficiently by the end of third grade.
Okay. So how would the reduction of accessibility to pre-K programs across the state, we're going to talk here in a minute about early learning grants, et cetera, how does that augment that, or how does that help achieve that particular goal as part of that challenge, part of your overall program? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, how does a reduction in access to pre-elementary school programs help achieve the goal of students reading proficiently by the end of third grade? Well, first I would say I hope that whatever happens with the state's budget that we don't necessarily reduce access. The department just got a grant for over $2 million to expand access. Whatever happens with the state budget, we'll continue to work to provide as many resources and opportunities as possible. Secondly, districts have a number of options for providing those types of services. Some districts use state resources, some have tuition-based programs, some work in cooperation with their municipalities. But I would also say that I wouldn't necessarily characterize cuts as being helpful, as I wouldn't expect somebody to characterize using the PFD from families as being helpful, or somebody else saying that taxing families that are already living paycheck to paycheck as being helpful. What is helpful is a sustainable budget, and I think that's true of pre-K and the goal of reaching third grade reading, and that is whatever the legislature decides and the governor about the budget, we're not going to let that change our goal of every student in the state being able to read proficiently by third grade.
Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. I can see that there might be some issues as far as matching and how much federal money we might be leaving on the table, because if we just did the 20%, this would be a large chunk of federal funds being left on the table. So could you get the committee the actual federal grants that it affects? Because it seems that you said some of this is going to programs that this really isn't actually the matching grant. So it would be helpful to find actually how much federal funds we will be maybe leaving on the table.
Through the chair, again for the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Johnston, to clarify, the $46 million that the Head Starts get in federal grants, they get directly from the federal government. They do not pass through the Department of Education. So none of them are expected to have, we have not heard that this reduction is going to close any of those or risk, have any of the $46 million at risk of losing any of that federal authority. They'll still receive it. They just have to make up the match through in-kind or any of their other local sources that they, or from within their own budgets. Does that
follow up?
Over.
But maybe I'm not hearing this correctly, but in an earlier response, you had mentioned that some of the Head Start programs really were not using this at all for their 20% match. So that was the breakdown I wanted, you know, where was it being used for the 20% match and where it was not, so we can get a better picture of the consequences.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I understand your question. And then just to clarify, I was saying that 5 of the 16 Head Starts that we provide this portion of the $6.8 million to have a waiver, so they do not have to meet that 20% match. They still get some of the $6.8 million, which has been typically used as a match, so they're using it even though it's not used towards their match.
Okay. And just the monetary breakdown would be helpful.
Yes.
Thank you.
And maybe if I could also just follow up on that. If we could, so it sounds like, well, if we could get a list of all 16 programs, just identify specifically who they are, which of the 5 have the waivers, and maybe I assume all 16 of them are getting a piece of the 6.8. I don't know if that is the case or is not the case. If you could let us know, and then I guess getting back to the point of the federal funds potentially being lost, if you could name again the 5 that have the waivers, and then how this is all, we just need to know what the impact is and how much we could be losing in terms of federal funds. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. I just so I understand this clearly, and it's, I guess, for whoever wants to answer, essentially there's every dollar that the state contributes, we get $7.50 through the federal Head Start program. That's what this suggests. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the part that might be getting confused is that this is what the state is putting forward towards these programs. Some of the Head Start entities have their own in-kind contributions, so it's not a one. We have to look at the whole picture. This is just a piece of the match requirement.
Follow up. We've heard the administration, I think, itself say we don't know how local communities will respond to the budget. We don't know what monies they will raise to maintain the services that are currently provided. Do we know, has anyone checked to see how these 16 agencies would respond to needing to come up with a total of almost $7 million?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe that there's staff members in the department who have had conversations with the Head Start agencies recently, and I can follow up with them to get a clear answer to your question about how this would how this reduction would impact them.
I would like that, Mr. Chairman. I've used the term, I don't know if I invented it, but I call it the Stevens Doctrine, and that is what Ted Stevens would do. He would let Washington worry about Washington, but bring home the revenue that we're entitled to under current rules and laws. And I'm gravely concerned that we're leaving countless dollars on the table in program after program. And I would like to know that match is a real thing that is achievable. Thank you.
I've had a discussion with my local Head Start organization, and they're under the umbrella of our regional Native organization, and they're currently using other funds to A, you know, fund the program, B, to help with their match. So it sounds like they're already doing that. I'm not sure where else they could get some of the match money unless the city, I suppose, were to come in somehow, or I'm just, I know they said that this was a concern, and so I just wanted to pass that on. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Definitely a policy question. We're looking at K through 12 education, and we're currently discussing a pre-K program. So I'm curious, is a pre-K program a core requirement for K through 12 education?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So we are the Department of Education and Early Development. Having said that, in the Moore case, Judge Gleason noted the importance of pre-K, but she stated in that case that it was not a constitutional mandate.
Thank you.
I don't see any further questions on this. Please continue.
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner, the last main bullet on slide six is a reduction of $1.2 million general funds to the early learning grants. These funds currently serve about 419 students in 9 school districts across Alaska. The funds were added in FY18 as a one-time increment to continue support for the pre-K programs affected by the Moore versus State in that Moore settlement, and then added to the base budget in FY19. And so this, along with one of the reductions noted on the next slide, $2 million to the pre-kindergarten grants, the funds are not at a level sufficient enough to serve students on a statewide basis. So it's just currently serving a small percentage of our pre-K students statewide.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the chair. Just for clarity's sake, when was our responsibility for the Moore settlement over, the states, or the?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I believe that was FY17 is when we finalized that.
Thank you.
If I could, Representative Ortiz, and then Josephson.
Teschner, the last statement, funding is not sufficient to serve the pre-kindergarten population on a statewide basis. Can you further elaborate as to why you make that point? In other words, what is it that you're trying to say with that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So this kind of, again, goes in line with the $2 million reduction to the pre-K grant. We can just advance ahead of that one. But similar to that one started out as a pilot program intended to grow over time, starting with $2 million and eventually make it to $10 million. Well, it never expanded beyond that $2 million. And so while the additional of the $1.2 million has allowed us to allow the department to provide grants to expand it even just a little bit, it's still only serving a small percentage of the pre-K students statewide. So that's why the funding is not sufficient, because it's only reaching a smaller percentage and not trying to reach all pre-K.
So then, for lack of a better word, so that is a justification for removing the funds? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Tease, that is one justification. These programs are also not set out in statute. And as the commissioner stated, pre-K is not, I can't remember exactly what you just said, but the department's, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. I think we'd find that if we looked at just what's constitutionally required, we could quickly collapse the government, at least its funding. But let me ask you about the Moore settlement. I haven't read it, but does it actually say that the obligation to contribute something as part of the pre-K program is time limited? It just strikes me, and maybe it does, but it strikes me as an odd thing for a judge to write. Perhaps she did. I don't know. Does anyone know whether she said as part of this settlement we need to care more about pre-K for this period of time and then not?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. First, I would say it might be best to get somebody from Department of Law to answer the questions about the settlement. So I don't, I'm I'm not an attorney. The settlements did have some time frames around them, but I wouldn't characterize the judge as saying, or the agreement as saying, pre-K is important for only a certain amount of time. It's just that's how the settlement came up.
Thank you.
Commissioner, just for folks watching on Gavel, can you give a very short description of the Moore settlement and how that was seeking to establish some equity in the quality of education? Maybe if you could add to that. Just very short and brief is fine.
Chair Foster, again, I would, I'll try to maybe say a couple of high points, but would encourage the committee, get the Department of Law to speak to the case and then the settlements that were subsequent to that that were worked out between the plaintiffs and the state. I've just taken some notes, you know, in the last few weeks as I know this is a question. This is a quote from the actual Moore case. She said, the primary question in this case is whether the public education system in Alaska is constitutionally adequate. At the end, throughout the case, the judge notes that funding is only one element, but she did not find that funding was inadequate. What she found was that the state, primarily the department, wasn't providing adequate oversight to districts that were not meeting, that students were not proficient.
I think that gives folks, I guess, the gist of what we're talking about. Any other further questions on this issue? Seeing none, Ms. Teschner?
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner. So moving on to slide 7, the first bullet on this one is a reduction of $320,000 of general funds to the Best Beginnings Grant. Currently, there's 27 Imagination Libraries serving 107 communities across Alaska. A $474,000 general fund reduction to the Parents as Teachers grants. So four grantees serving 159 students and 134 families in six communities in Alaska.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Just with regard to the Best Beginnings program itself, and especially with regard to the Imagination Libraries, has there been discussion with a nonprofit group maybe taking on this particular program? For example, our Rotary in Mat-Su contributes quite a bit to the Imagination Library program. So are there discussions from other civic organizations that may be able to come in and help take over this?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I have not had any specific conversations myself. I can check with department staff to see if they have, but I am sure that there are nonprofits that would be more than willing to help support the continuation of this program.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I think, first of all, I need to declare a conflict. My daughter-in-law, Grace Johnston, is on the board of Best Beginnings, and if I could be of help to Representative Sullivan Leonard, Best Beginnings is a nonprofit group, and so they are constantly out trying to raise funds and get further support from other groups. Thank you.
So we covered parents. So the third bullet, $2 million reduction to the pre-kindergarten grants. So currently those funds serve for 504 students in 11 school districts across Alaska. It started out as a pilot program in 2010 and has, as I stated earlier, has not grown into the original intent of that pilot program. And again, the funds, as I stated earlier, just they're not sufficient to meet as pre-K students on a statewide level. And the last bullet on this slide is a $6 million reduction. This removes one-time multi-year funding. Chair Foster, Ortiz has a question.
Representative Ortiz.
I was just kind of getting the cue. Go ahead and finish up. And
$6 million to remove one-time multi-year funding, so FY19 and FY20. So this is removing that increment from the base budget in 20, since we've already received the full increment in FY19 for the 2 years. And those are currently, as noted on this slide, in FY19, serving 231 students in 6 districts, and then in 20, expected to serve 761 students in 9 districts. And so the same 6 districts are also participating in FY20. There's just an additional 3 districts.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So going along the same lines with Representative Carpenter's point about how the state constitutionally is mandated to take care or to try to provide a quality education for students 5 through, is it an age or grade 12? What is the language? Is it 18? Is that what it is?
This is a kindergarten through 12.
Going along that line, is there any evidence to suggest that if the investments are made at the pre-K level, age five grade level, that it actually, if students have opportunities at the pre-K level, does it actually save money to the education costs of providing education to the 5 kindergarten through 12th grade level? Is there any evidence to suggest that it actually saves money?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So there is strong evidence that if you have a student reading proficiently by the end of third grade, that that's more efficient for the system after that, and certainly more productive for the student. When it comes to pre-K, the legislature could find a whole host of people that would show up and advocate for pre-K, and another host of people that would show up and say that the impact diminishes over time, and at a certain point, the benefit isn't there as strongly. So there's research on both sides of the issue that the legislature could access. And there's also research associated with universal and targeted, and does it help some students more than others?
Follow up.
So as the Commissioner of Education and your past experience as a superintendent and teacher, is your gut call that it probably does help out the big picture in terms of providing better outcomes for students in their grades 5 through 12 experience?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So, I'm reluctant to give a gut call. I'm not even sure what that may be. But I'll offer you this, and that is, pre-K is one factor in a student being successful by the end of third grade. And so that one factor may or may not help some students. So it may make a difference in some students. It may not make a difference in other students. Targeted pre-K, I think, has shown to be very helpful in places in this country. But again, helpful in that it's one element, one component of preparing kids for school.
Oh, what?
And I would agree with you. I'm sure that's true. Can you tell us some of the other components that would probably be critical?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, critical for school success?
Success. You said that's one component. Pre-K is one component. What are some of the other components?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there's as many components as there are differences in students. So family.
Okay, family.
Health. Community. Economics. The quality of the curriculum when they get to kindergarten. The quality of instruction. There are endless factors in kids' lives that contribute to school success, funding being only one of them.
Pre-K being only one of them. Not just funding, but pre-K, is what you're saying. follow-up?
Follow-up.
So the point, though, is you and I was a former educator, we didn't have a lot of input on family. We didn't have a lot of input on individual economics of the particular child or those kinds of things. But we did have input on this one thing that we're talking about. We can make a difference in this one thing. Those other things are important, no doubt. Family, all those kind of things. I saw that time and time again. But deed doesn't really have much influence on those other things. But they do have influence on whether or not a student has an opportunity for pre-K. Agreed?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Does deed have influence on whether a student gets pre-K? I think the legislature has influence on whether students have pre-K because you control the budget, and then we just implement the budget that you provide. We certainly will do everything possible to support pre-K opportunities throughout the state with whatever resources the legislature decides to appropriate.
Thank you.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my school board days, we were asked every school year to enroll four-year-olds. And we always said no, because once you make an exception, you lower your age, you have to make it for everybody. So this pre-K program was designed for the four-year-old group. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, I believe it was 3 and 4 year olds.
3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And that program had its launch year last year. Six school districts, 231 students, fiscal year 2019 were served last year.
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, so are you referring to the $6
million? Correct.
So those were... just to clarify, it was a one-time additional grant to help expand the pre-K offering that we have. So basically expanding the $2 million grant and the $1.2 million that was on the previous slide. We break out on the slides what each pot of money and how many students those are serving. So in 19, from the 6 million, 213 students are being served through that pot, a portion of the $6 million in six school districts. Does that answer?
And my school board member hat would sound alarms about rolling out a program that you are not going to sustain into the future. What were you hoping to learn, or were you behind this program, or do you have any results, early results about the success of three-year-olds and four-year-olds and a pre-K at the six school districts that were the model for this program? Or is it just too early? There's just...
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, I think it's too early for us to have results in direct response to your question. I know that these grants, the intent behind them was for districts to provide innovative ways to provide pre-K. So if these funds were basically an innovative grant, so if districts applied for them and can show that they would be able to provide something that they could sustain in the long run when the funds were no longer available.
And what was the time duration for this program initially? 3 years?
Through the chair, 2 years. It was a 2-year grant.
And reasonably thinking, would that be enough time to really measure success? And how would you define success?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, it would be a reasonable amount of time to determine success for the particular students that were in those programs. I'm not sure it would be a reasonable amount of time to make broad conclusions about pre-K programs.
Yeah, and I look at that, and this is, I guess, more of a comment. I'll be done. If you roll out something like this, you better be ready for every school district to want to enroll four-year-olds into a program. So the fiscal note on something like that, in my school board days, again, we would be hesitant to accept this grant and pursue this without a good, warm feeling about sustainability, and do we want to do this in the future? I guess that's more commentary than anything else, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnston? Representative Josephson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that it's important that we move along, but I think this is important subject. For the commissioner, it appears that if we abandon our pre-K programs, we would be the sixth of 50 states to essentially not have them. And I know that isn't necessarily the proposal, that there could be other in-kind contributions or nonprofits, but it gets us close to not having them. It certainly spells retreat. And I guess what I'm wondering is, we're not really going to debate the efficacy of pre-K. I mean, it, broadly speaking, it started with Head Start, I think, in around 1965 with Lyndon Johnson during the Great Society, and it's never not existed since then. And 45 states do it. We're not really saying that it doesn't have value, right? It's sort of baked in that it does, doesn't it? I mean, it's just a policy call that we're saying we can't afford it. Isn't that sort of where we are?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'll let OMB speak to particular policy calls on what was in and not in the budget, but I think when the whatever the budget is that comes out, the other end of the legislature and the governor signs, that school districts will then have to go through a similar process, and it's not always a this is important or unimportant, but what's most important. And I certainly wouldn't sit here and argue that pre-K is unimportant.
Thank you.
I've got a question. Commissioner, and maybe you might know the answer to this. With regard to the pre-K school districts, the school districts that have it, not all school districts have it. Do you know how each school district was chosen to be given funds? Was there some desire to try to achieve regional diversification or and balance, or was it that there were some districts where the need was greatest for improvement? Do you know how, or was it just a matter of school districts applied for the money and whoever wanted it, they had a shot at it? Do you know how that was done?
Chair Foster, so I may be going too broad, and you can pull me back in, but you know, when we talk about pre-K, we're talking about several different kinds of programs in the state as they currently exist. And so one part of those was the Moore settlements that targeted money to those plaintiff districts that were associated with that. Head Start is another pre-K kind of program that the department doesn't necessarily regulate or control, though that money has supported some of those programs in the past. Then there's other district-initiated and sponsored programs that have propped up everywhere. So the pre-K picture in the state is bigger than just what's represented on this screen right there.
Thank you. I believe we're at the end of the presentation. I don't know if there's anything. I did have one other thing. If you didn't have anything else, is there anything else on this?
Oh, I'm done.
You're done. Okay,
yep.
Great. Thanks. I just wanted to also note that Ms. Andrea Noble Pellant was in the room. She's with the Alaska State Council on the Arts. At the very beginning of your presentation, you had mentioned that there were going to be a number of positions that would go away. And I didn't know if anybody had any questions with regard to the Alaska State Council on the Arts. We have somebody in the room available if there were questions. Representative LeBon.
This is on a different topic, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
To go back to WAMI, the program lists 205 active borrowers that receive benefits from the program. Do we know how many of those 205 active borrowers are in Alaska practicing?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I don't know exactly how many are actively practicing in Alaska, but we can definitely follow up with the committee.
It's important to know that number. Thank you.
I wanted to also throw out there, I respect the fact that everybody's got a different opinion on how we fund these various programs, and I know that, you know, one of the perspectives is if we couldn't do it for everybody, then we should do it for nobody, and I guess my personal philosophy is, you know, we should embrace the smaller numbers that we have and try to build on that, and that's my own personal philosophy, and I know that's going to be a policy call that we have to make at the end of the day, and I just wanted to put that out there. So with that, if there are no further questions, we will move on to the next issue. I think Ms. Sanders, you're staying at the table, so thank you for being here, and we'll move on to committee will be taking up the governor's supplemental bills, House Bill 53 and 54. And the Office of Management and Budget will be walking the committee through the items in both bills. So with that, I think the OMB director will not be with you today. Is that correct? Okay. So with that, please continue or start your presentation, Ms. Sanders.
For the record, again, my name is Lacey Sanders, Budget Director for the Office of Management and Budget. As you may be aware, there were two supplemental bills that the administration introduced on January 28th, which was the statutory required deadline for the supplemental bills. The first one that I'm going to talk about today is HB 53, and this is what we're referring to as the Disaster Relief Supplemental Bill. The items within the disaster supplemental bill are related to the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake. This includes a capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund, Federal Highway Administration funding within the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, as well as state facility costs not covered by insurance. In addition, there is a section which we're including in this bill which has to do with the funding for the Department of Natural Resources fire suppression activity. The total of the supplemental bill is $139 million. Of that, $102 million is federal receipt authority that is being requested, as well as $37,300,000 related to general fund. A portion of that is match, and a portion of that is direct unrestricted general funds. The slide number four is just a high-level visual for you on disaster supplemental appropriations from 2014 to 2019. Disasters are unpredictable, and the amount of money that's needed from a year to year is not going to be a stable amount of money. It's going to vary depending on what is happening and what is in the balance of the Disaster Relief Fund. The administration is concerned about the current level of the Disaster Relief Fund. It is, as of March 5th, an unobligated fund balance of $362,900 and is projected to be fully expended by April 1st, 2019. The Department of Military and Veteran Affairs is the department that manages this fund. With the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, they are diligently analyzing the outstanding disasters that they have on their books to make funding available for the Cook Inlet earthquake and being able to respond to the Cook Inlet earthquake. The urgency is due to the balance of the fund getting so low. This slide is just representing just a high-level overview of the items that are in the bill. I'll walk through these briefly. Again, the first item is in relation to the Department of Natural Resources fire suppression. There's a $7.9 million request. The amount that has historically been in the operating budget for fire suppression is low. It is not sufficient. And it is anticipated that approximately $7.9 million will be needed as they head into the fire season. The second item is an appropriation for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This is Federal Highway Administration funding. It is $65 million of federal receipts that has a match requirement of $6.5 million. This funding will be used to work on roads that have been damaged by the earthquake. This is a multi-year appropriation, meaning we have requested it as a supplemental so that they can start working on it sooner than later and continue the work and continue to collect the receipts from the federal government for work into FY20. The next
question.
Item.
Okay, thanks. Please proceed.
Sure. Okay. The next item is an appropriation of $1 million. This appropriation will go to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. It is all unrestricted general funds. This funding is being requested for costs that are not covered for state facilities that the insurance is not covering. So there are The Department of Administration and the Department of Transportation is working with risk management within the Department of Administration to address all of facility damages. There are some things that are deemed not coverable by insurance, and the administration has put forward $1 million request. Some things, for example, there is a correctional facility that had damage to a parking lot that needs to be repaired. That will cover a portion of this. There are some just administrative costs associated with buildings. If things got broken in the office, that type of request would be covered under that appropriation. The last item is the largest item. This is a fund capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund. As I mentioned earlier, the balance is anticipated to be zero soon. The request was is for $21,901,000. In addition, the department is also asking for federal authority related to what the disaster declaration is allowing. We do realize that this is a little bit redundant. The operating bill allows any receipts that are received on behalf of a disaster to be deposited into the disaster relief fund, but it was an opportunity to make clarify how much was necessary. And these are estimates. The $21.9 million was based on an estimate. That estimate has been revised now that the disaster declaration was signed and received. That amount has actually been reduced to approximately $12 million need specific to the Cook Inlet earthquake. However, the administration is requesting to continue the $21 million appropriation in anticipation of any spring disasters that are coming, with the balance of the disaster relief fund being at zero. We would like to ensure that there is money in the fund to quickly respond to any disasters in the near future.
Do you know how much, what was the balance same time last year, about April 1? Was it around the same?
Chair Foster, I don't have the balance of as of last year. I can provide that to you. I do recall last session there were several appropriations of funding into the disaster relief fund to try and bring the balance of the fund up, because it was the amount that had been appropriated over a few years was very low, and we were concerned with the balance of the fund, and the legislature did address that last session. I believe it was $10 million In 2018, that was deposited, and another $2 million in 2019. But again, that has all been utilized with the disaster.
Representative Johnston.
Actually, thank you, through the chair. I was going to ask a similar question, but it would be helpful just to have a 10-year look back at the fund balance, the history.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, yes, the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs has that, and we can provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, do you know, Ms. Sanders, whether school districts are eligible for any of these funds?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't, but if I can, we have the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs on the line. Brian Fisher, who is the State Coordinating Officer for Homeland Security and Emergency Management, is on the line and may be able to answer your question.
Would you like him to?
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Fisher, if you heard the question, do you know the answer?
Yes, for the record, this is Brian Fisher. I'm with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. I'm the State Coordinating Officer for response to the earthquake disaster. And through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, school districts, local governments, certain private nonprofits are all eligible for disaster relief funding.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the insurance claims that have been denied, I guess is probably the best way to put it at this point, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. What is the process for scrutinizing that? Insurance companies like to not pay when they can. So I'm just curious, from a public policy perspective, what is our policy for scrutinizing whether that's a legit denial or not?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, my understanding is the items that we're talking about here are not eligible to be covered under insurance, so I don't believe that these are denials, so to speak. I do know that the Department of Administration has risk management, which is a group with and they're the people that work on the insurance claims. They may be able to speak further to what adjustments they have to do or what conversations that they have. I'm not an expert in that area.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
The next slide represents two amendments that were recently submitted. They were submitted to the legislature on March 6th. As I mentioned earlier, we are still working with the agencies to work through the needs and what costs have been identified related to the Cook Inlet disaster. The Department of Transportation is specifically requesting $1 million for administrative activities associated with surface transportation. So these are costs that are not eligible by the Federal Highway Administration or by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. This is for example, if somebody in each agency has administrative staff that are working to support any engineers or surveyors or so on and so forth, those administrative costs may not be covered by the Federal Highway Administration, and they've identified approximately $1 million associated with the disaster that they need additional funding for. The second item is an appropriation for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It's a federal funding of $1 million related to the Disaster Employment Assistance Program. So this is if any of individuals had interruption due to the earthquake, they can apply for the individual assistance or self-employment funding. And the Department of Labor has some existing authority within their budget. They need about $1 million more in authority to make sure that this funding is handed out to those that are eligible.
Do we have any questions? Seeing no questions, I believe HB 53 something that I think there's a number of interested parties that are wanting to see this one move through fairly quickly, and so we're going to be working to try to get that through and work with the Senate, the administration on that one. So with that, Ms. Sanders.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, there is a second supplemental bill. This is our traditional supplemental request outside of the disaster. I'm sorry, traditional might not be the correct phrase. These are supplemental requests that are outside of the disaster need. We separated them into a separate bill in anticipation of needing to move the disaster bill more quickly. So this bill includes both operating and capital appropriations. And again, they are related to 2019. There are reductions in spending, formula program adjustments. There are salary adjustments that are related to the classification of the trooper positions, various operating capital projects, and a few transfers back to the general fund. As you can see at the bottom, the little table representing the totals, the total bill is for $110,400,000. Of that, $92 million is associated with federal funding, $17.7 million is other funds, and $51,800 is general funds. As I mentioned earlier, supplemental requests vary from year to year, not in the same way that disasters are unpredictable, but costs can also be unpredictable. It's just a summary of the supplementals over the years to highlight that the amounts vary from year to year. In your packet, you should have a spreadsheet outlining the supplemental appropriations. I walked through them briefly during a House informational meeting. I can walk through them again, Representative Foster, if you would like, or I can take questions associated with what's on the spreadsheet.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, you thank you. Item 16, yep. In the operating budget, mm-hmm. In the past, as you're well aware of, that our large supplementals could be driven by underfunding Medicaid. Is this going to be sufficient?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, we have worked with the Department of Health and Social Services frequently over the last few months to identify what that need is and should be, and we do feel that this is sufficient to meet the Medicaid claims through the remainder of the fiscal year.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 16 again. Can you remind me about how majority of that $15 million is, if it gets the approval of the legislature, how that's dispersed, who quote benefits from that added revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I am not a Medicaid expert, but these are the payments that are due to providers.
Providers, okay.
It's my understanding, yes.
Okay. That's what my
get us through the end of the fiscal year and reimburse them for the costs that are incurring in the current fiscal year and not to end payments and shift them into the next fiscal year. That is the intention of this appropriation.
Thank you.
Do we have any further questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair. Item number 18, is this because of the inability to hire and therefore spend?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. This is, in part, this is funding that is, let me just clarify, this is aligning the Village Public Safety Officer program funding. It is our understanding that the grantees that are receiving this funding are not able to fully expend on an annual basis the amount of money that they receive in the grant line. And that is due to, in some part, the inability to fully fill the VPSO positions.
Ms. Sand, or Representative Josephson, did you have a follow-up on that before I ask my question on that?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sanders, if you can answer the question, if not, I understand. Last year we put language in the operating budget that said if there were excess funds, those would be used for recruitment and retention. Do you know if any efforts were made to increase recruitment and retention of VPSO officers in rural Alaska?
To the chair, Representative Foster, I am recalling conversations that they with the Department of Public Safety that did happen, that they were working on it. But I can follow up with the department to see what efforts were made and just clarify and confirm my response to you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The AGDC, $5 million that's going back. Do you know why?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC, when we were working on supplementals, we asked each agency to review their funding that they had been allocated for the current year and the funding that they had in funds. And they contributed $5 million back to the general fund as not needed to get them through the rest of the fiscal year. They are working on what their plan moving forward is going to be. And this was in excess of what they needed for the current year. That doesn't mean that they won't come back to you in the future when they have a developed plan on what their needs are going to be moving forward.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Knopf.
So on, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that point, this request come in before the FERC moved the process back 4 more months for the EIS, so that extends AGDC's time frame. Do we still feel that we can get through with remaining funds?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf. It is my understanding, and I have not heard otherwise since this proposal was made, that the money that they have is sufficient to get them through the end of the fiscal year. We can have a follow-up conversation if you would have different information, but that is the information that I have.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes, thank you. What's the date that we're looking at that this money was identified and you were notified to put it on the spreadsheet?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the supplementals that were put forward on January 28th. It has been a few months. If there is a concern, they would reach out to us, and I have not heard from them.
Thank you.
Yes,
Representative Ortiz.
Saunders, going back to line 12, I know what that money represents, the $20 million. My question is, we had some discussion in the informational hearing that we had prior to the organization being formed about the distribution of those funds to the district, and I think I recall that the distribution hasn't been made, of course, but that it would be made as soon as some sort of action was taken on the part of the legislature. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. If the legislature takes action and it is apparent that the requested proposal of the reappeal is not moved forward, then funding will be distributed.
Follow-up?
So, Mr. Chairman, it's also my understanding that in order for the $20 million not to arrive in the districts, it's not a matter of an action taken. We've already taken the action in the previous legislature for that $20 million to be distributed. So I guess what I'm saying is this is a catch-22. In other words, it's my understanding we don't have to take an action. The only action we would take is if we chose not to distribute that $20 million. So is there anything we can do, maybe an intent statement or something like that, so that if, in fact, it's the majority of the votes that follow our last year's action, if that's the majority of the body, of both bodies, would it take some sort of intent statement, or how do you view that?
I think we can just, leave it out of the supplemental that we end up passing, number one. leave this out. And then also, if we want to strengthen that, you could certainly do a joint resolution with the Senate. You could do a sense of the House, you know, to send a message that this is what we intend. And so those are the options.
Yeah, I guess I understand that. But and the question would be, though, so it's going to take some sort of action on the supplemental, which I don't know when that's going to happen. But at the same time, the districts are still kind of left in limbo. So is there something we could do absent the specific action on the supplemental, which would then allow the distribution of the funds?
In the meantime, until a supplemental is passed,
right,
is what you're
right,
saying.
Right.
You know, I don't envision us taking months to pass out a supplemental. You know, it might be a month or something like that. And, you know, certainly we could talk about if there are issues in the meantime, what our options are. But, you know, I just don't see it being something that's long and drawn out. So,
thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, anything else, Ms. Sanders? Okay. Well, seeing nothing else, we will cancel Monday's 9 a.m. meeting. We are setting up 9 a.m. meetings on Monday, or we are noticing those in case we run out of time and we need the extra time. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, March 11th at 1:30 p.m. And at the meeting, the committee will be considering two governor's appointees, Kevin Clarkson, Attorney General Designee for the Department of Law, and Kelly Chewbacca, Commissioner Designee for Department of Administration. And the committee will also continue its department budget overviews with the Department of Law, as well as the courts. So with that, if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:06 p.m.